Our collective nightmare. A lake-studded Polish forest where sunlight filters through leaves and tourists buy audio guides to walk past the skeleton of a genocide command center, then eat pierogi in a hotel that opened last year. The Wolf's Lair was built fast with rail access, forced labor, concrete walls 6 meters thick, and a camouflage so natural the trees pretended it was always part of the woods. It had everything a murderous bureaucracy needed. Bunkers, barracks, 2 airfields, a railway station, a tea house, a cinema, a casino, and more than 50,000 landmines in the ring around it. It was both a fortress and a resort for the men who signed orders that killed millions. Hitler spent about 800 days there. He fed his dog, read his papers, and slept while millions burned. They blew up the bunkers in January 1945 when the Red Army came close, which is the modern euphemism for "we tried to erase what we built." The concrete laughed at them. Ruins survived. Moss and stalactites moved in. A tree now grows out of Bormann's shelter like an indifferent monument. Time and weather did what no tribunal could. They made the place ugly and undeniably ordinary. A bomb planted in a briefcase in July 1944 came closest to changing that trajectory. It killed a few, failed to kill the architect of the madness. And the racket that followed killed thousands more in reprisal. History's odd arithmetic. An attempt to stop the machine made it grind harder for a while. After the war, the site rotted, then became a museum, then a polished tourist product. 300,000 people visit a year. There are numbered plaques, paths, an observation platform, and an audio guide. In 2024, a hotel and restaurant were added. Modern conveniences by the ditch where decisions about mass murder were made. You can now sleep near an overgrown Hitler bunker and book a table for dinner. That feels like progress, or at least a clever way to monetize conscience. There is controversy because the aesthetics of ruin can attract the wrong admirers, and because turning atrocity into a day trip risks a tenderness for kitsch. Historians warn. Far-right groups fidget. The economy shrugs and continues to sell tickets. The surreal fact is simple and ugly. A place built to coordinate war and annihilation is now a place to reflect, to snack, to snap photos. Nature has reclaimed parts of it, tourists stroll, and a hotel offers pierogi with a side of historical context. We saved the site as a memory, and then made it comfortable enough for forgetting. That seems to be the bargain we prefer. Preservation with room service, the past curated and consumable, the nightmare kept tidy enough for an overnight stay.
Caroline Levitt posted an Instagram of her baby bump in front of a Christmas tree and announced she's expecting a girl in May. She thanked God, President Trump, and Susie Wiles for the pro-family environment at the White House. Then she reminded everyone she went back to work 4 days after giving birth because, quote, "the president literally put his life on the line. This is peak first world problem energy. We're outraged that someone had to choose between a nap and a briefing. Not the economy, not climate, not healthcare. The real story is maternity timing and backdrop curation." The baby bump snap says, "I'm maternal." The holiday lights say, "I'm festive." And the caption says, "I'm a model employee." It's like LinkedIn and Hallmark had a child and it's already being scheduled around press briefings. Pro-family environment now means you get a gold star for bringing a newborn into the corporate grind. In practice, it looks like, congratulations, you can have a child, as long as you also have a Plan B childcare binder, a crisis-level adrenaline response, and an Instagram filter that makes exhaustion look like enlightenment. Motherhood is the closest thing to heaven on earth, which is very aspirational if heaven includes 3 a.m. feedings and a calendar invite titled Urgent Statement. Only in our first world narrative do we applaud the person who rushes back to work like it's heroic while also photographing the bump for PR. The real flex is not juggling baby bottles and podiums, it's selling that juggling as a value proposition. Meanwhile, the rest of us are trying to figure out whether the moral of the story is family values or flexible optics. Either way, someone clap for the person who can breastfeed and brief at the same time. Bonus points if it's in holiday lighting.
The Daily Dose of Dystopia. Northeast Storm. A storm sneaks up the map like bad news with appointments. Snow, sleet, and freezing rain are peeling away the thin varnish of normalcy across the Great Lakes and Northeast, and the heavy stuff is still on the schedule. New York's 3 airports and Philadelphia's hub are racking up hundreds of delays and cancellations, because why not make travel as unreliable as the rest of the infrastructure? Michigan already lost more than 40,000 customers to the electrical gods as ice bows trees and power lines into surrender. More than 23 million people are living under winter storm warnings through Saturday. New York City, which hasn't remembered real snow since 2022, could see up to 11 inches in places. Northeast Queens and northern sections getting the worst of that urban snowfall lottery. A narrow corridor from Long Island into Connecticut and nearby New York State could collect 8 to 12 inches. The tri-state, seen as a whole, might pick up 5 to 9 inches if the storm plays fair. Sleet could cheat the totals in the city. Governors handed out state of emergency declarations like little badges of impending inconvenience. New Jersey slapped travel limits on some big rigs. Connecticut, Pennsylvania, and New York urged people to stay off the roads. City crews salted streets, readied plows, and closed a ferry early. Rituals of preparedness performed so the rest of civilization can pretend it's in control. Philadelphia faces a messy mix, 1 to 3 inches of snow and sleet, or whatever the atmosphere decides is fashionable when cold meets moisture. Western Pennsylvania is under an ice warning for 0.2 to 0.3 inches, enough to snap limbs, topple lines, and make travel nearly impossible per the Weather Service. Washington, D.C. is getting mostly rain, with Northern Maryland flirting with sleet and freezing rain, because even the capital likes variety in its chaos. The pattern is familiar. Airports clog, power blinks out, officials declare emergencies, crews move like clockwork to delay the collapse by a few hours. Nature does its thing. Systems test their seams, commuters get stranded, people light candles and gripe online. The storm will pass, grids will reboot, flights will resume, and the next small unraveling will be waiting to remind everyone how thin the whole setup really is.
From CNN, human evolution's biggest mystery has started to unravel. How 2025 tipped the scales. Imagine learning your family tree by checking the lint in your pocket and finding out you're related to a man named after a fantasy novel. That is essentially what happened in 2025, when scientists finally started to put a face on the Denisovans, the mysterious relatives we only knew by a 60,000-year-old pinky bone and a lot of awkward genetic small talk. The skull nicknamed Dragon Man turned out to be less dragon and more inconvenient reminder. Humans are mosaics. DNA from the gunk on his teeth. Yes, the fossilized dental calculus your dentist would judge, and proteins from the dense bits of his skull pointed to the same strange conclusion. The Denisovans weren't some distant, neat branch on a family tree. They were neighbors, occasional lovers, and genetic pickpockets, leaving bits of themselves in us so we could carry on without asking questions. We like tidy stories. Homo sapiens rises, builds tools, writes poems. Instead, the story is messy. Neanderthals, Denisovans, a Denisovan with a Neanderthal mother, a genome that borrows from an unknown super archaic ghost. Maybe Homo erectus, maybe a hobbit cousin, maybe someone we haven't dug up yet because they were shy. The deeper we look, the more it feels like standing at a family reunion where everyone is related to everyone and no one brought name tags. There's a certain cruelty to how the present treats the past. A skull gets stashed in a well for decades, later to be classified with a dramatic new species name, Homo longi, so we can feel clever. A molar from a cave gives us a 200,000-year-old high-resolution genome, and with it, the realization that a gene that helps your saliva behave might be a souvenir from an ancient handshake between species. Somewhere in your saliva is a travel itinerary you didn't sign. Paleo artists reconstruct faces from bone like forensic sketch artists for ghosts. They tell us Dragon Man would have the kind of brow ridge that makes modern foreheads look unnecessary. And yet, if he rode the subway in a hoodie, most of us would only glance and think, interesting jawline. The stranger is suddenly ordinary. The familiar is suddenly borrowed. The funny part, if you can call it that without crying into your coffee, is that our desperate quest for origins keeps revealing how unoriginal we are. Names change, timelines shift back by hundreds of thousands of years, and every new fossil seems to whisper, "You were always already a collaboration." If human identity were a manuscript, it would be a palimpsest scribbled over by countless hands. We read it hoping for a single author, but what we get is group editing, crossouts, marginalia in extinct languages. The comforting myth of pure lineage collapses into a communal mess of interbreeding, lost populations, and sticky dental deposits that tell the real stories. Maybe that's the point. We aren't singular masterpieces destined to solve cosmic riddles. We are practical experiments in survival, an accidental chorus singing bits of many voices. It's less romantic than myth, but oddly more honest. A species whose story is written in other people's teeth. If you ever feel profoundly unique, remember, there's a Denisovan in you somewhere, possibly judging your playlist.
A single ticket sold at a Murphy USA in Cabot, Arkansas, transformed an ordinary convenience stop into the epicenter of a billion-dollar fever dream. The Powerball hit for an estimated $1.8 billion, second largest in U.S. history, then was immediately folded into the same mechanics that keep millions of people buying hope for pocket change. The winner has 180 days to claim a prize that most people will insist on collapsing into a lump sum, $834.9 million before taxes. The choice between instant gratification and a 30-year drip? A framing device that treats poverty as a psychological problem and sudden wealth as a logistical nightmare. Either way, the state wins. Ticket sales pour steady revenue into public coffers, while the spectacle distracts from policy failures that could actually reduce precarity. Arkansas lets winners shield their names if prizes top $500,000 with identities. Protected for 3 years. Winners over $1 million must appear in person to claim. Other states offer similar cosmetics of protection. Anonymous claims, blind trusts, LLCs, because raw windfalls invite predators and paper vultures. In Florida, an entity called Saltines Earnings LLC once claimed a $1.6 billion Mega Millions prize, turning identity into a corporate veil and turning civic transparency into private property. Anonymity is not merely privacy theater. It is self-defense against relentless requests, threats, and financial violence. It is also an admission that the social fabric has eroded to the point where money must be hoarded, armored, and legally fenced off. The recommended first moves for winners: hire lawyers, financial advisors, and a mental health professional, read less like instructions for a fortunate citizen, and more like survival protocols for the newly untethered wealthy. Financial advice centers on immediate triage. Pay off debt, tuck away savings, manufacture charitable donations for tax advantage. The essential lesson: navigate fortune the way capital navigates risk, privately, strategically, and with a team that converts human need into balance sheet outcomes. The official advice functions as a private industry onboarding packet for an unregulated experiment in concentrated wealth. The small winner's circle expands outward. The Murphy USA that sold the ticket will receive the capped selling commission, $50,000 in this case, a tiny memorial token compared to the headline number. That commission structure is a neat little reminder. Capitalism monetizes hope at every level, then circulates crumbs back to the vendor, as if that sustains anything beyond appetite. Stories of winners who implode, bankruptcies, and broken relationships are treated as cautionary folklore. They do not indict the system that manufactured the lottery in the first place, a state-sponsored, precisely marketed mechanism that extracts a regressive tax from the poor under the guise of entertainment and miracle. The winner's purchase is hailed as serendipity. The millions of small-ticket buyers are a perpetual pipeline of deferred revolt. Winning, when it happens, is framed as buying time. An oddly elegiac sales pitch for an economy that commodifies time itself. The luxury of time becomes the only publicly acknowledged non-material dividend. Otherwise, the prize dissolves into estate plans, tax strategies, private prisons of wealth. The Powerball cycle begins again, as scheduled, because mass spectacle must be replenished. The drawing is a ritual that keeps people participating in the same market of fantasies, each ticket a tiny subscription, to the hope that someone, somewhere, will be rescued by luck, while the structures that produce desperation remain untouched.